Scholastic Audio presents The Dream Thieves, Book 2 of The Raven Cycle, by Maggie Stiefvater. Read by Will Patton. What if you slept? And what if in your sleep you dreamed? And what if in your dream you went to heaven? And there plucked a strange and beautiful flower? And what if when you awoke, you had the flower in your hand? Ah, what then? Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Those who dream by night in the dusty recesses of their minds wake in the day to find that it was vanity. But the dreamers of the day are dangerous men, for they may act their dreams with open eyes to make it possible. T.E. Lawrence. I loathe people who keep dogs. They are cowards who haven't got the guts to bite people themselves. August Strindberg. Prologue. A secret is a strange thing. There are three kinds of secrets. One is the sort everyone knows about, the sort you need at least two people for. One to keep it, one to never know. The second is a harder kind of secret, one you keep from yourself. Every day, thousands of confessions are kept from their would-be confessors, none of these people knowing that their never-admitted secrets all boil down to the same three words. I am afraid. And then, there is the third kind of secret. The most hidden kind. A secret no one knows about. Perhaps it was known once, but was taken to the grave. Or maybe it is a useless mystery, arcane and lonely, unfound because no one ever looked for it. Sometimes, some rare times, a secret stays undiscovered because it is something too big for the mind to hold. It is too strange, too vast, too terrifying to contemplate. All of us have secrets in our lives. We're keepers or kept from, players or played. Secrets and cockroaches, that's what will be left at the end of it all. Ronan Lynch lived with every sort of secret. His first secret involved his father. Neil Lynch was a braggart poet, a loser musician, a charming bit of hard luck bred in Belfast but born in Cumbria, and Ronan loved him like he loved nothing else. Though Neil was a rogue and a fiend, the Lynches were rich. Neil's employment was mysterious. He was gone for months at a time, though it was hard to say if this was because of his career or because of his being a scoundrel. He always returned with gifts, treasure, and unimaginable amounts of money. But to Ronan, the most wondrous thing was Neil himself. Every parting felt like it would be the last, and so every return was like a miracle. "When I was born," Neil Lynch told his middle son, "God broke the mold so hard the ground shook." This was already a lie, because if God truly had broken the mold for Neil, he'd made himself a knockoff 20 years later to craft Ronan and his two brothers Declan and Matthew. The three brothers were nothing if not handsome copies of their father, although each flattered a different side of Neil. Declan had the same way of taking a room and shaking its hand. Matthew's curls were netted with Neil's charm and humor. And Ronan was everything that was left, molten eyes and a smile made for war. There was little to nothing of their mother in any of them. "It was a proper earthquake," Neil clarified as if anyone had asked him, and knowing Neil, they probably had. 4.1 on the Richter scale. Anything under 4 would have just cracked the mold, not broken it. Back then, Ronan was not in the business of believing, but that was all right, because his father wanted adoration, not trust. "And you, Ronan," Neil said. He always said Ronan differently from other words, as if he had meant to say another word entirely, something like knife, or poison, or revenge, and then swapped it out for Ronan's name at the last moment. When you were born, the rivers dried up and the cattle in Rockingham County wept blood. It was a story he had told more than once, but Ronan's mother, Aurora, insisted it was a lie. She said when Ronan emerged, the trees all grew flowers, and the Henrietta ravens laughed. When his parents bickered back and forth about his birth, Ronan never pointed out that both versions could be true. Declan, the oldest of the Lynch brothers, once asked, "And what happened when I was born?" Neil Lynch looked at him and said, "I wouldn't know, I wasn't here." When Neil said Declan, it always sounded like he meant to say Declan. And then Neil vanished for another month. Ronan took the opportunity to search the barns, which is what the sprawling Lynch farm was known as, for evidence of where Neil's money came from. He found no clues of his father's work, but he did discover a yellowed newspaper clipping in a rusting metal box. It was from the year his father was born. Dryly, it reported the story of the Kirkby-Stephen earthquake, felt through northern England and southern Scotland. 4.1. Anything less than a 4 wouldn't have broken it, only cracked it. That night, Neil Lynch came home in the blackness, and when he woke, he found Ronan standing above him in the small white master bedroom. The morning sun made them both snowy as angels, which was the better part of a lie already. Neil's face was smeared with blood and blue petals. "I was just dreaming of the day you were born," Neil said. "Ronan." He wiped the blood on his forehead to show Ronan that there was no wound beneath it. The petals snared in the blood were shaped like tiny stars. Ronan was struck with how sure he was that they had come from his father's mind. He'd never been more sure of anything. The world gaped and stretched, suddenly infinite. Ronan told him, "I know where the money comes from." "Don't tell anyone," his father said. That was the first secret. The second secret was perfect in its concealment. Ronan did not say it. Ronan did not think it. He never put lyrics to the second secret, the one he kept from himself, but it still played in the background. And then, there was this. 3 years later, Ronan dreaming of his friend Richard C. Gansey III's car. Gansey trusted him with all things except for weapons. Never with weapons, and never with this. Not Gansey's hell-tinged 73 Camaro slicked with black stripes. In his waking hours, Ronan never got any farther than the passenger seat. When Gansey left town, he took the keys with him. But in Ronan's dream, Gansey was not there, and the Camaro was. The car was poised on the sloped corner of an abandoned parking lot, mountains ghosted blue in the distance. Ronan's hand closed around the driver's side door handle. He tried his grip. It was a dream strength, only substantial enough to cling to the idea of opening the door. That was all right. Ronan sank into the driver's seat. The mountains and the parking lot were a dream, but the smell of the interior was a memory. Gasoline and vinyl and carpet and years whirring against one another. "The keys are in it," Ronan thought. And they were. The keys dangled from the ignition like metallic fruit, and Ronan spent a long moment holding them in his mind. He shuffled the keys from dream to memory and back again. And then he closed his palm around them. He felt the soft leather and the worn edge of the fob, the cold metal of the ring and the trunk key, the thin, sharp promise of the ignition key between his fingers. Then he woke up. When he opened his hand, the keys lay in his palm, dream to reality. This was his third secret. 1. Theoretically, Blue Sergeant was probably going to kill one of these boys. "Jane!" The shout came from across the hill. It was directed toward Blue, although Jane was not her real name. "Hurry up!" As the only non-clairvoyant in a very psychic family, she'd had her future told again and again, and each time it said she would kill her true love if she tried to kiss him. Moreover, it had been foretold this was the year she'd fall in love. And both Blue and her clairvoyant half-aunt Neve had seen one of the boys walking along the Invisible Corpse Road this April, which meant he was supposed to die in the next 12 months. It all added up to a fearful equation. At the moment, that particular boy, Richard Campbell Gansey III, looked pretty unkillable. In the humid wind at the top of the wide green hill, an ardently yellow polo shirt flapped against his chest and a pair of khaki shorts slapped his gloriously tanned legs. Boys like him didn't die. They got bronzed and installed outside public libraries. He held a hand toward Blue as she climbed the hill from the car, a gesture that looked less like encouragement and more like he was directing air traffic. "Jane, you've got to see this." His voice was full of the honey-baked accent of old Virginia money. As Blue staggered up the hill, telescope on her shoulder, she mentally tested the danger level. "Am I in love with him yet?" Gansey galloped down the hill to snatch the telescope from her. "This isn't that heavy," he told her and strode back the way he'd come. She did not think she was in love with him. She hadn't been in love before, but she was still pretty sure she'd be able to tell. Earlier in the year, she had had a vision of kissing him, and she could still picture that quite easily. But the sensible part of Blue, which was usually the only part of her, thought that had more to do with Richard Campbell Gansey III having a nice mouth than with any blossoming romance. Anyway, if fate thought it could tell her who to fall for, fate had another thing coming. Gansey added, "I would have thought you had more muscles. Don't feminists have big muscles?" "Decidedly not in love with him." "Smiling when you say that doesn't make it funny," Blue said. As the latest step in his quest to find the Welsh King Owen Glendower, Gansey had been requesting hiking permission from local landowners. Each lot crossed the Henrietta Ley Line, an invisible, perfectly straight energy line that connected spiritually significant places and circled Cabeswater, a mystical forest that straddled it. Gansey was certain that Glendower was hidden somewhere within Cabeswater, sleeping away the centuries. Whoever woke the king was supposed to be granted a favor, something that had been on Blue's mind recently. It seemed to her that Gansey was the only one who really needed it. Not that Gansey knew he was supposed to be dead in a few months, and not that she was about to tell him. "If we find Glendower soon," Blue thought, "surely we can save Gansey." The steep climb brought them to a vast, grassy crest that arched above the forested foothills. Far, far below was Henrietta, Virginia. The town was flanked by pastures dotted with farmhouses and cattle, as small and tidy as a model railroad layout. Everything but the soaring blue mountain range was green and shimmery with the summer heat. But the boys were not looking at the scenery. They stood in a close circle. Adam Parrish, gaunt and fair. Noah Cherney, smudgy and slouching. And Ronan Lynch, ferocious and dark. On Ronan's tattooed shoulder perched his pet raven chainsaw. Although her grip was careful, there were finely drawn lines from her claws on either side of the strap of his black muscle tee. They all eyed something Ronan held in his hands. Gansey cavalierly tossed the telescope into the buoyant field grass and joined them. Adam allowed Blue into their circle as well, his eyes meeting hers for a moment. As always, his features intrigued Blue. They were not quite conventionally handsome, but they were interesting. He had the typical Henrietta prominent cheekbones and deep-set eyes, but his version of them was more delicate. It made him seem a little alien, a little impenetrable. "I'm picking this one, Fate," she thought ferociously. "Not Richard Gansey III. You can't tell me what to do." Adam's hand glided over her bare elbow. The touch was a whisper in a language she didn't speak very well. "Open it up," he ordered Ronan. His voice was dubious. doubting Thomas, Ronan sneered, but without much vitriol. The tiny model plane in his hand spanned the same breadth as his fingers. It was formed of pure white featureless plastic, almost ludicrously lacking in detail, a plane-shaped thing. He opened the battery hatch on the bottom. It was empty.
"Well, it's impossible then," Adam said. He picked off a grasshopper that had hurled itself onto his collar. Everyone in the group watched him do it. Since he'd performed a strange ritual bargain the month before, they'd been scrutinizing all of his movements. If Adam noticed this extra attention, he didn't indicate it.
"It won't fly if it has no battery and no engine."
Now Blue knew what this thing was. Ronan Lynch, keeper of secrets, fighter of men, devil of a boy, had told them all that he could take objects out of his dreams. Example A, chainsaw. Gamzee had been excited. He was the sort of boy who didn't necessarily believe everything but wanted to. But Adam, who had only gotten this far in life by questioning every truth presented to him, had wanted proof.
"It won't fly if it has no battery and no engine," Ronan mimicked in a higher-pitched version of Adam's faint Henrietta drawl.
"Noah, the controller."
Noah scuffled in the clumpy grass for the radio controller. Like the plane, it was white and shiny, all the edges rounded. His hands looked solid around it, though he had been dead for quite a while, and by all rights should appear more ghostly. He was always rather living-looking when standing on the ley line. "What's supposed to go inside the plane if not a battery?" Gansey asked. Ronan said, "I don't know." In the dream it was little missiles, but I guess they didn't come with. Blue snarled a few seed heads off the tall grass. "Here."
"Good thinking, maggot."
Ronan stuffed them into the hatch. He reached for the controller, but Adam intercepted it and shook it by his ear.
"This doesn't even weigh anything," he said, dropping the controller into Blue's palm.
It was very light, Blue thought. It had five tiny white buttons, four arranged in a cross shape and one off by itself. To Blue, that fifth button was like Adam, still working toward the same purpose as the other four, but no longer quite as close as the others.
"It will work," Ronan said, taking the controller and handing the plane to Noah. "It worked in the dream, so it'll work now. Hold it up."
Still slouching, Noah lifted the tiny plane between thumb and forefinger as if he were getting ready to launch a pencil. Something in Blue's chest thrummed with excitement. It was impossible that Ronan had dreamt that little plane, but so many impossible things had happened already.
"Kira,"
Chainsaw said. This was her name for Ronan.
"Yes," agreed Ronan. Then to the others he said imperiously, "Count it down."
Adam made a face, but Gansey, Noah, and Blue obligingly chanted, 5, 4, 3. On blastoff, Ronan pressed one of the buttons. Soundlessly, the tiny plane darted from Noah's hand and into the air. It worked. It really worked. Gansey laughed out loud as they all tipped their heads back to watch its ascent. Blue shielded her eyes to keep sight of the tiny white figure in the haze. It was so small and nimble that it looked like a real plane thousands of feet above the slope. With a frenzied cry, Chainsaw launched herself from Ronan's shoulder to chase it. Ronan pitched the plane left and right, looping it around the crest, Chainsaw close behind. When the plane passed back overhead, he hit that fifth button. Seed heads cascaded from the open hatch, rolling off their shoulders. Blue clapped and reached her palm out to catch one. "You incredible creature," Gansey said. His delight was infectious and unconditional, broad as his grin. Adam tipped his head back to watch something still and far away around his eyes. Noah breathed, "Whoa," his palm still lifted as if waiting for the plane to return to it. And Ronan stood there with his hands on the controller and his gaze on the sky, not smiling, but not frowning either. His eyes were frighteningly alive, the curve of his mouth savage and pleased. It suddenly didn't seem at all surprising that he should be able to pull things from his dreams. In that moment, Blue was a little in love with all of them. Their magic, their quest, the
their awfulness and strangeness. Her raven boys. Gansey punched Ronan's shoulder.
Glendower traveled with magi, did you know?
Magicians, I mean. Wizards. They helped him control the weather. Maybe you could dream us a cold snap.
Har.
They also told the future, added Gansey, turning to Blue.
Don't look at me, she said shortly. Her lack of psychic talents was legendary.
Or helped him tell the future, Gansey went on, which did not particularly make sense, but indicated that he was trying to un-irritate her. Blue's short temper and her ability to make other people's psychic talents stronger were also legendary.
Shall we go?
Blue hurried to pick up the telescope before he could get to it. He shot her a look, and the other boys fetched the maps and cameras and electromagnetic frequency readers. They set off on the perfectly straight ley line, Ronan's gaze still directed up to his plane and to Chainsaw, a white bird and a black bird against the azure ceiling of the world. As they walked, a sudden rush of wind hurled low across the grass, bringing with it the scent of moving water and rocks hidden in shadows, and Blue thrilled again and again with the knowledge that magic was real. Magic was real. Magic was real.
2. Declan Lynch, the oldest of the Lynch brothers, was never alone. He was never with his brothers, but he was never alone. He was a perpetual motion machine run by the energy of others. Here, leaning over a friend's table at a pizza joint. Here, drawn into an alcove with a girl's palm to his mouth. Here, laughing over the hood of an older man's Mercedes. The congregation was so natural that it was impossible to tell if Declan was the magnet attracting or the filings attracted. It was giving the gray man a not inconsiderable difficulty in finding an opportunity to speak with him. He had to loiter around the Aglin B. Academy campus for the better part of a day. The waiting wasn't entirely disagreeable. The gray man found himself quite charmed by the oak-shaded school. The campus possessed a shabby gravitas that was only possible with age and affluence. The dorms were emptier than they would have been during school term, but they were not empty. There were still the sons of CEOs traveling to third world countries for photo ops, and the sons of touring punk musicians with heavier things to bring along than 17-year-old accidental progeny, and the sons of men who were dead and never coming to retrieve them. These summer sons, few as they were not entirely noiseless. Declan Lynch's dorm was not quite as pretty as the other buildings, but it was still handsome with money. It was a remnant from the 70s. A technicolor decade the gray man had enormous fondness for. The front door was meant to be accessible only with a key code, but someone had propped it open with a rubber door stopper. The gray man clucked in disapproval. A locked door wouldn't have kept him out, of course, but it was the thought that counted. Actually, the gray man wasn't certain he believed that. It was the deed that counted. Inside, the dorm offered the neutral-toned welcome of a decent hotel. From behind one of the closed doors, a Colombian hip-hop track raged, something seductive and violent. It wasn't the gray man's sort of music, but he could hear the appeal. He glanced at the door. The dorm rooms at Aglinby were not numbered. Instead, each door bore an attribute the administration hoped its students would walk away with. This door was labeled Mercy. It was not the one the gray man was looking for. The gray man headed in the opposite direction, reading doors. Diligence. Generosity. Piety. Until he got to Declan Lynch's. Effervescence. The gray man had been called effervescent once in an article. He was fairly certain it was because he had very straight teeth. Even teeth seemed to be a prerequisite for effervescence. He wondered if Declan Lynch had good teeth. There was no sound coming from behind the door. He tried the doorknob softly. Locked. Good boy, he thought. Down the hall, the music pounded like the apocalypse.
The gray man checked his watch. The rental car place closed in an hour, and if he despised anything, it was public transportation. This would have to be brief. He kicked in the door. Declan Lynch sat on one of the two beds inside. He was very handsome, with a lot of dark hair and a rather distinguished Roman nose. He had excellent teeth. "What's this?" he said. By way of answer, the gray man picked Declan up off his bed and slammed him against the adjacent window. The sound was curiously muffled. The loudest part of it was the boy's breath bursting from him as his spine railed against the sill, but then he was back up and fighting. He wasn't a shoddy boxer, and the gray man could tell that he expected the surprise to give him an advantage. But the gray man had known before he arrived that Neil Lynch had taught his sons to box. The only thing the gray man's father had taught him was how to pronounce trebuchet. For a moment, they fought. Declan was skilled, but the gray man was more so. He tossed the boy about his dorm room and used Declan's shoulder to sweep awards and credit cards and car keys from the dresser. The thump of his head against a drawer was indistinguishable from the bass down the hall. Declan swung, missed. The gray man kicked Declan's legs from beneath him, hurled him to the wall by the piece of furniture, and then approached for another round, pausing only to pick up a motorcycle helmet that had rolled into the middle of the floor. With a sudden burst of speed, Declan used the dresser to haul himself up, then pulled a handgun from a drawer. He pointed it at the gray man. "Stop," he said simply. He flicked off the safety. The gray man had not expected this. He stopped. Several different emotions battled for precedence on Declan's face, but shock was not one of them. It was clear the gun was not for the possibility of an attack. It was for the eventuality of one. The gray man considered what it must have been like to live like that, always waiting for your door to be kicked in. Not pleasant, he thought. Probably not pleasant at all. He didn't think Declan Lynch would balk at shooting him. There was no hesitation in his stance. His hand trembled a bit, but the gray man thought that was from injury, not fear. The gray man considered for a moment. Then he hurled the helmet. The boy fired a shot, but it was nothing but noise. The helmet crashed into his fingers, and while he was still stunned, the gray man stepped forward and plucked the gun from his numb hand. He took a moment to put the safety back on. Then the gray man smashed the gun against Declan's cheek. He did it a few times just to get his point across. Finally, he allowed Declan to sink to his knees. The boy was holding on to consciousness quite valiantly. With his shoe, the gray man pressed him the rest of the way to the ground and then eased him onto his back. Declan's eyes were focused on the ceiling fan. Blood ran out of his nose. The gray man knelt and pressed the barrel of the gun to Declan's stomach, which rose and fell calamitously as he gasped for air. Tracing the gun over the boy's right kidney, he said conversationally, "If I shot you here, it would take you 20 minutes to die, and you'd be done no matter what the medics did for you. Where's the Grey Warren?" Declan said nothing. The gray man gave him some time to consider his reply. Head wounds tended to make thoughts slower. When Declan remained quiet, he dragged the muzzle down to Declan's thigh. He pressed hard enough that the boy gasped. "Here, you die in 5 minutes. Of course, I don't need to shoot you for that. The point of your umbrella over there would do it just as well. You'd be gone in 5 minutes and wishing for it in 3. Declan closed his eyes, one of them anyway. The left eye was already swollen most of the way shut. "I don't know," he said eventually. His voice sounded full of sleep. "I don't know what that is." "Lies are for your politicians," the gray man said without vehemence. He just wanted Declan to know that he knew about his life, his internship. He wanted him to know that he'd done his research. "I know where your brothers are right now. I know where your mother lives. I know the name of your girlfriend. Are we clear?"
"I don't know where it is," Declan hesitated. "That's the truth. I don't know where it is. I just know it is."
"Here is the plan," the gray man stood up. "You're going to find that thing for me, and when you do, you're going to give it to me, and then I will be gone."
"How do I find you to give it to you?"
I don't think you understand. I am your shadow. I'm the spit you swallow. I'm the cough that keeps you up at night.
Declan asked, Did you kill my father?
Neil Lynch. The gray man tried the words out in his mouth. In his opinion, Neil Lynch was a pretty lousy father, getting himself killed and then allowing his sons to live in a place where they propped the security doors open. The world, he felt, was full of bad fathers. He asked me that question, too.
Declan Lynch exhaled unevenly, half a breath, and then the other half.
Now the gray man could see he was finally afraid.
Okay, Declan said. I'll find it. Then you'll leave us alone, all of you.
The gray man set the pistol back in its drawer and pushed it closed. He checked his watch. He had 20 minutes to pick up his rental car. He might upgrade to a midsize. He hated compact cars nearly as much as he hated public transportation. Yes.
Okay, Declan said again.
The gray man withdrew from the room, shutting the door part way. It wouldn't quite close right. He had messed up one of the hinges when he'd entered. He was sure there was an endowment somewhere that would cover the damages. He paused, watching through the crack of the door. There was still more to learn from Declan Lynch today. For several minutes, nothing happened. Declan lay there, bleeding and crooked. Then the fingers of his right hand crabbed across the ground to where his cell phone had fallen. He didn't immediately dial 911, though. With agonizing slowness, his shoulder was almost certainly dislocated, he punched in another number. Immediately, a phone rang on the opposite bed. It was, the gray man knew already, the bed that belonged to Declan's youngest brother, Matthew. The ringtone was an Igloo and Hartley song that the gray man knew but couldn't condone. The gray man already knew where Matthew Lynch was, floating in a boat on the river with some local boys. Like his older brother, never content to be alone. Declan let his youngest brother's phone ring for longer than it needed to, his eyes closed. Finally, he pressed end and dialed another number. It still wasn't 911. Whoever it was didn't pick up, and whoever it was made Declan's already strained expression even tighter. The gray man could hear the tinny sound of the phone ringing and ringing, then a brief voicemail that he couldn't catch. Declan Lynch closed his eyes and breathed,
Ronan, where the hell are you?
3.
The problem is exposure, Gansey told the phone, half shouting to be heard over the engine. If Glendower really could be found just walking along the ley line, I don't see how he wouldn't have already been found in the past few hundred years.
They were headed back to Henrietta and the pig. Gansey's furiously orange-red ancient Camaro. Gansey drove because when it was the Camaro, he always drove. And the conversation was about Glendower because when you were with Gansey, the conversation was almost always about Glendower. In the back seat, Adam's head was tipped back in a way that gave equal attention to the phone conversation and his fatigue. In the middle, Blue leaned forward to better eavesdrop as she picked grass seed off her crochet leggings. Noah was on her other side, although one could never be sure he'd stay corporeal the farther they got from the ley line. It was a tight fit, even tighter in this heat with the air conditioning straining escaping through every crevice in the crevice-filled vehicle. The Camaro's air conditioning had only two settings, on and broken. To the phone, Gansey said, That's the only thing. Ronan leaned on the cracked black vinyl of the passenger side door and chewed on the leather bands on his wrist. They tasted like gasoline, a flavor that struck Ronan as both sexy and summery. For him, it was only sometimes about Glendower. Gansey needed to find Glendower because he wanted proof of the impossible. Ronan already knew the impossible existed. His father had been impossible. He was impossible. Mostly, Ronan wanted to find Glendower because Gansey wanted to find Glendower. Only sometimes did he think about what would happen if they actually discovered him. He thought it might be a lot like dying. When Ronan had been smaller and more forgiving of miracles, he'd considered the moment of death with rhapsodic delight. His mother had told him that when you looked into the eyes of God at the pearly gates, all the questions you ever had were answered. Ronan had a lot of questions. Waking Glendower might be like that. Fewer angels attending, and maybe a heavier Welsh accent. Slightly less judgment.
No, I understand that. Gansey was using his Mr. Gansey professorial voice, the one that exuded certainty and commanded rats and small children to get up, follow me.
It had worked on Ronan anyway.
But if we assume Glendower was brought over between 1412 and 1420, and if we assume his tomb was left untended, natural soil accumulation would have hidden him. Starkman suggests that medieval layers of occupation might be under a sediment accumulation of 5 to 17 feet. Well, I know I'm not on a floodplain, but Starkman was working under the assumption that...
Right. Sure.
What do you think about GPR?
Blue looked at Adam. He didn't lift his head as he translated in a low voice.
Ground-penetrating radar.
The person on the other end of the phone was Roger Mallory, a stunningly old British professor Gansey had worked with back in Wales. Like Gansey, he had studied the ley lines for years. Unlike Gansey, he was not using them as a means to find an ancient king. Rather, he seemed to study them for a weekend diversion when there were no parades to attend. Ronan hadn't met him in person and didn't care to. The elderly made Ronan anxious.
Flux great gradiometry, Gansey suggested. We've already taken a plane up a few times. I just don't know if we'll see much more until winter when the leaves are gone.
Ronan shifted restlessly. The successful demonstration of the plane had left him hyper-alive. He felt like burning something to the ground. He pressed his hand directly over the air conditioning vent to prevent heat exhaustion. You're driving like an old woman.
Gansey waved a hand, the universal symbol for shut up.
Beside the interstate, 4 black cows lifted their heads to watch the Camaro go by. If I was driving, Ronan thought about that set of Camaro keys he had dreamt into existence, shoved in a drawer in his room. He let the possibilities unwind slowly in his mind. He checked his phone. 14 missed calls. He dropped it back into the door pouch.
What about a proton magnetometer?
Gansey asked Mallory. Then he added crossly, I know that's for underwater detection. I would want it for underwater detection. It was water that had ended their work today. Gansey had decided that the next step in their search was to establish Cabe's Water's boundaries. They'd only ever entered the forest from its eastern side and never made it to any of the other edges. This time, they'd approached the forest from well north of their previous entry points. Devices trained to the ground to alert them to when they found the northern electromagnetic boundary of the forest. After a several-hour walk, the group had instead come to a lake. Gansey had stopped dead in his tracks. It wasn't that the lake had been uncrossable. It only covered a few acres, and the path around lacked treachery. And it wasn't that the lake had stunned him with its beauty. In fact, it was quite unlovely as far as lakes went. An unnaturally square pool sunk into a drowned field. Cattle or sheep had worn a mud path along one edge. The thing that stopped Gansey cold was the obvious fact that the lake was man-made. The possibility that parts of the ley line might be flooded should have occurred to him before, but it hadn't. And for some reason, although it was not impossible to believe that Glendower was still somehow alive after hundreds of years, it was impossible to believe he was able to pull off this feat beneath tons of water. Gansey had declared, We have to find a way to look under it. Adam had replied, Oh, Gansey, come on. The odds. We're looking under it. Ronan's plane had crashed into the water and floated, unreachable. They'd walked the long way back to the car. Gansey had called Mallory. As if, Ronan thought, a crusty old man 3,000 miles away will have any bright ideas. Gansey hung up the phone. Well? Adam asked. Gansey met Adam's eyes in the rearview mirror. Adam sighed. Ronan thought they could probably just go around the lake. But that would mean plunging into Cabe's Water headlong. And although the ancient forest seemed like the most likely location for Glendower, the sizzling volatility of the newly woken ley line had rendered it a little unpredictable. Even Ronan, who had little care for whether or not he shuffled off this mortal coil, had to admit that the prospect of being trampled by beasts or accidentally getting stuck in a 40-year time loop was daunting. The entire thing was Adam's fault. He'd been the one to wake the ley line, though Gansey preferred to pretend it had been a group decision. Whatever bargain Adam had struck in order to accomplish it seemed to have rendered him a little unpredictable as well. Ronan, a sinner himself, wasn't as struck by the transgression as he was by Gansey's insistence that they continue to pretend Adam was a saint. Gansey was not a liar. This untruth didn't look good on him. Gansey's phone chirruped. He read the message before letting it drop next to the gear shift with a strangled cry. Abruptly melancholy, he lolled his head dismally against the seat. Adam gestured for Ronan to pick up the phone, but Ronan despised phones above almost every other object in the world. So it sat there with its eyebrows raised, waiting. Finally, Blue strained forward far enough to snatch it. She read the message out loud. "Could really use you this weekend if not too much trouble. Helen can pick you up. Disregard if you have activities." "Is this about Congress?" Adam asked. The sound of the word Congress made Gansey sigh heavily and urged Blue to whisper in withering derision, "Congress." It hadn't been long since Gansey's mother had announced she was running for office. In these early days, the campaign had yet to directly influence Gansey, but it was inevitable he'd be called upon. They all knew that clean, handsome Gansey, intrepid teen explorer and straight-A student, was a card that no hopeful politician could avoid playing. "She can't make me," Gansey said. "She doesn't have to," Ronan sniffed. "Mama's boy."
"Dream me a solution."
"Don't have to. Nature already gave you a spine. You know what I say? Fuck Washington."
"This is why you never have to go to things like this," Gansey replied.
In the other lane, a car pulled up beside the Camaro. Ronan, a connoisseur of street battles, noticed it first, a flash of white paint. Then a hand stretched out the driver's side window, a middle finger extended over the roof. The other car shot forward and then fell back, then shot forward again.
"Oh, Christ," Gansey said. "Is that Kavinsky?"
Of course it was Joseph Kavinsky, fellow Aglenby Academy student and Henrietta's most notorious recreational forger. Kavinsky's infamous Mitsubishi Evo was a thing of boyish beauty, moon white, with a voracious black mouth of a grill and an immense splattered graphic of a knife on either side of the body. The Mitsubishi had just been released from a month-long stint in the police impound. The judge had told him that if he was caught racing again, they'd crush the Mitsubishi and make him watch like they did to the rich punks street racers out in California. Rumor had it Kavinsky had laughed and told the judge he'd never get pulled over again. He probably wouldn't. Rumor had it Kavinsky's father had bought off Henrietta's sheriff. To celebrate the Mitsubishi's release from impound, Kavinsky had just put 3 coats of anti-laser paint on the headlights and bought himself a new radar detector. Rumor had it.
"I hate that prick," Adam said.
Ronan knew he ought to hate him, too. The window rolled down to reveal Joseph Kavinsky in the driver's seat, his eyes hidden behind white-rimmed sunglasses that reflected only the sky. The gold links of the chain around his neck glittered a grin. He had a refugee's face, hollow-eyed and innocent. He wore a lazy smile, and he mouthed something to Gansey that ended with "unt." There was nothing about Kavinsky that wasn't despicable. Ronan's heart surged, muscle memory. "Do it," he urged. The 4-lane interstate, gray and baked, stretched in front of them. The sun ignited the red-orange of the Camaro's hood, and beneath it, the massively souped-up and tragically underutilized engine rumbled drowsily. Everything about the situation demanded someone's foot crushing an accelerator.
"I know you are not referring to street racing," Gansey said tersely.
Noah gave a hoarse laugh.
Gansey didn't make eye contact with Kavinsky or Kavinsky's passenger, the ever-present Prokopenko.
The latter had always been friendly with Kavinsky in the sort of way that an electron was friendly with a nucleus, but lately he seemed to have acquired official crony status.
"Come on, man," Ronan said.
In a dismissive, sleepy voice, Adam said, "I don't know why you think that would work out. Pig's got a load of 5 people."
"Noah doesn't count," Ronan replied.
Noah said, "Hey,
you're dead. You don't weigh anything."
Adam continued, "We've got our airco on, and he's probably in his Evo, right? 0 to 60 in 4 seconds. What's this do, 0 to 60 in 5? 6? Do the math."
"I've beaten him," Ronan said. There was something dreadful about seeing a race dissolving in front of him. It was right there. Adrenaline waiting to happen. And Kavinsky, of all people. Every inch of Ronan's skin tingled with useless anticipation.
"On that car, you haven't. Not in your BMW."
"In that car," countered Ronan. "In my BMW. He's a shitty driver."
Ganzi said, "It's irrelevant. It's not happening. Kavinsky's a dirtbag."
In the other lane, Kavinsky lost patience and pulled slowly ahead. Blue caught sight of the car. She exclaimed, "Him? He's not a dirtbag. He's an asshole."
For a moment, all of the boys in the Camaro were quiet, contemplating where Blue might have learned that Joseph Kavinsky was an asshole. Not that she was wrong, of course. "You see," Ganzi said, "Jane concurs."
Ronan caught a glimpse of Kavinsky's face looking back at them through his sunglasses, judging them all cowards. Ronan's hands felt itchy. Then Kavinsky's white Mitsubishi charged ahead in a faint cloud of smoke. By the time the Camaro had reached the Henrietta exit, there was no sign of them. Heat rippled off the interstate, making a mirage of the memory of Kavinsky, like he'd never been. Ronan slumped in his seat, all the fight sucked out of him. "You never want to have any fun, old man."
"That's not fun," Ganzi said, putting on his turn signal. "That's trouble." 4. The gray man had not always intended to be a heavy. Point of fact, the gray man had a graduate degree in something completely unrelated to roughing people up. At one point, he had even written a not unsuccessful book called Fraternity in Anglo-Saxon Verse, and it had been required reading in at least 17 college courses across the country. The gray man had carefully collected as many of these course reading lists as he could find and placed them in a folder along with cover flats, first pass pages, and 2 appreciative letters addressed to his pen name. Whenever he required a small burst of fireworks to his heart, he would remove the folder from the bedside drawer and look at the contents while enjoying a beer, or 7. He had made a mark. However, as delightful as Anglo-Saxon poetry was to the gray man, it served him better as a hobby than as a career. He preferred a job he could approach with pragmatism, one that gave him the freedom to read and study at his convenience. So here he was in Henrietta. It was, the gray man thought, quite an agreeable life, after all. After chatting with Declan Lynch, he checked into the Pleasant Valley Bed and Breakfast just outside of town. It was quite late, but Shorty and Patty Wetzel didn't seem to mind. "How long will you be with us?" Patty asked, handing the gray man a mug with an anatomically incorrect rooster on it. She eyed his luggage on the portico, a gray duffel bag and a gray hard-sided suitcase. "Probably 2 weeks to start," the gray man replied. "A fortnight in your company." The coffee was astonishingly terrible. He shouldered off his light gray jacket to reveal a dark gray V-neck. Both of the Wetzels gazed at his suddenly revealed shoulders and chest. He asked, "Do you have anything with a hair more spine to it?" With a giggle, Patty obligingly produced 3 Coronas from the fridge. "We don't like to appear like lushes, but lime?" "Lime," agreed the gray man.
For a moment, there was no sound but that of 3 consenting adults mutually enjoying an alcoholic beverage after a long day. The 3 emerged from the other side of the silence, firm friends.
2 weeks, Shorty asked.
The gray man was endlessly fascinated by the way Shorty formed words. The most basic premise of the Henrietta accent seemed to involve combining the five vowels basic to the English language into four.
Give or take, I'm not sure how long this contract will last.
Shorty scratched his belly.
What do you do?
I'm a hitman.
Hard to find work these days, is it?
The gray man replied. I would have had an easier time in accounting.
The Wetzels enjoyed this hugely. After a few minutes of home-baked laughter, Patty ventured, "You have such intense eyes."
"I got them from my mother," he lied. The only thing he'd ever gotten from his mother was an inability to tan.
"Lucky woman," Patty said.
The Wetzels hadn't had a boarder in several weeks, and the gray man allowed himself to be the focus of their intense welcome for about an hour before excusing himself with another Corona. By the time the door shut behind him, the Wetzels were decided supporters of the gray man.
"So many of the world's problems," he mused, "were solved by sheer human decency."
The gray man's new home was the entire basement of the mansion. He stalked beneath the exposed beams, peering through each open door. It was all quilts and antique cradles and dim portraits of now-dead Victorian children. It smelled like 200 years of salt ham. The gray man liked the sense of past. There were a lot of roosters, however. Returning to the first bedroom, he unzipped the duffel he'd left there. He sorted through slacks and cosmetics and stolen artifacts wrapped in boxer briefs until he got to the smaller devices he'd been using to detect the Grey Worn. On the small high window beside the bed, he set an EMF detector, an old radio, and a geophone, and then he unpacked a seismograph, a measuring receiver, and a laptop from the suitcase. All of it was provided by the professor. Left to his own devices, the gray man used more primitive location tools. At the moment, the dials and readouts twitched crazily. He'd been told the Grey Worn caused energy abnormalities, but this was just noise. He reset the instruments that had reset buttons and shook the ones without. The readings remained nonsensical. Perhaps it was the town itself. The entire place seemed charged. It was possible, he thought without much dismay, that the instruments would be useless. I have time, though. The first time the professor had put him onto this job, it had sounded impossible. A relic that allowed the owner to take objects out of dreams. Of course, he'd wanted to believe in it. Magic and intrigue. The stuff of sagas. And in the time since that first meeting, the professor had acquired countless other artifacts that shouldn't have existed. The gray man tugged the folder out of his duffel and opened it on the bedspread. A course syllabus lay on top. Medieval History, Part 1. Required reading. Fraternity in Anglo-Saxon Verse. Sliding on a set of headphones, he queued up a playlist of the Flaming Lips. He felt essentially happy. Beside him, the phone rang. The gray man's burst of joy fizzled. The number on the screen was not a Boston number, and therefore not his older brother. So he picked it up. "Good evening," he said.
"Is it?"
"I suppose." It was Dr. Colin Greenmantle, the professor who paid his rent, the only man with eyes more intense than the gray man's.
"Do you know what would make calling you easier? If I knew your name so I could say it."
The gray man didn't reply. Greenmantle had lasted 5 years without his name. He could last another 5 without it. Eventually, the gray man thought, if he resisted using it for long enough, he himself might forget his own name and become someone else entirely.
"Did you find it?"
Greenmantle asked. "I've just arrived," the gray man reminded him.
"You could have just answered the question. You could have just said no."
"No isn't the same as not yet." Now Greenmantle was silent. A cricket chirruped on the ground just outside the tiny window. Finally he said,
"I want you to move fast on this one."
For quite a long time now, the gray man had been hunting for things that couldn't be found, couldn't be bought, couldn't be acquired, and his instincts were telling him that the Grey Worn was not a peace that was going to come quickly. He reminded Greenmantle that it had already been 5 years since they'd first begun looking for it.
Irrelevant.
Why the sudden hurry? There are other people looking for it. The gray man cast his eyes to the instruments. He was not eager to allow Greenmantle to ruin his leisurely exploration of Henrietta. He said what Declan Lynch had already known. There have always been other people looking for it.
They haven't always been in Henrietta.
5. Later that night, back in Monmouth Manufacturing, Ronan woke up. He woke like a sailor scuttles a ship on rocks, plunging, heedless, with as much speed as he could muster, braced for the impact. Ronan had dreamt he'd driven home. The way to the barns was twisted as a light bulb's filament, all corkscrew turns and breathless lifts through broken terrain. These were not Gansey's tamed mountains and foothills. These eastern hills of Singer's Falls were hasty green folds, sudden rises, and precipitous hatchet marks in the rock-strewn forests. Mist rose from them, and clouds descended into them. Night, when it came to the barns, was several shades darker than it was in Henrietta. Ronan had dreamt this drive again and again, more times than he'd ever driven it in real life. The pitch-black roads, the old farmhouse suddenly looming, the single eternal light in the room with his silent mother. But in his sleep, he never made it home. He hadn't this time either, but he had dreamt something he wanted to bring back. In his bed, he struggled to move. Just after waking, after dreaming, his body belonged to no one. He looked at it from above, like a mourner at a funeral. The exterior of this early morning Ronan didn't look at all like how he felt on the inside. Anything that didn't impale itself on the sharp line of the sleeping boy's cruel mouth would be tangled in the merciless hooks of his tattoo, pulled beneath his skin to drown. Sometimes Ronan thought he would be trapped like this, floating outside his body. When he was awake, Ronan was not permitted to go to the barns. When Neil Lynch had died, been killed, not died, beaten to death with a tire iron that was still lying beside him when Ronan had found him, a weapon still coated in his blood and his brains and the better part of his face, a face that had been alive maybe only an hour before, 2 hours before, while Ronan was dreaming only yards away, a full night's sleep, a feat never again to be performed. A lawyer had explained the details of their father's will to them. The Lynch brothers were wealthy, princes of Virginia, but they were exiles. All of the money was theirs, but on one condition. The boys were never to set foot on the property again. They were to disturb neither the house nor its contents, including their mother. "It will never stand up in court," Ronan had said. "We should fight it." Declan had said, "It doesn't matter. Mom is nothing without him. We might as well go." "We have to fight," Ronan had insisted. Declan had already turned away. "She's not fighting." Ronan could move his fingers. His body was his again. He felt the cool wooden surface of the box in his hands, his ever-present leather wristband sliding toward his palms. He felt the ridges and valleys of the letters carved into the box, the crevices of the drawers and movable pieces. His pulse surged in him, the thrill of creation, the ragged awe of making something from nothing. It was not the easiest thing to take something from a dream. It was not the easiest thing to take only one thing from a dream. To bring even a pencil back was a small miracle. To bring any of the things from his nightmares, no one but Ronan knew the terrors that lived in his mind. Plagues and devils, conquerors and beasts. Ronan had no secret more dangerous than this. The night churned inside him. He tangled himself around the box, getting a hold of his thoughts again. Now he was beginning to shake a little. He remembered what Gansey had said.
You incredible creature.
Creature was a good word for him, Ronan thought. What the hell am I? Maybe Gansey was awake.
Ronan and Gansey both suffered from insomnia, though they had very different solutions for it. When Ronan couldn't or wouldn't sleep, he listened to music or drank or went out into the streets looking for vehicular trouble, or all three. When Gansey couldn't sleep, he studied the bristling journal he'd compiled of all things Glendower, or when he was too tired to read, used a cereal box and a bin of paints to add another building to the waist-high model of Henrietta he'd constructed. Neither could really help the other find sleep, but sometimes it was better just to know you weren't the only one awake. Ronan padded out of his room with chainsaw scooped in his arm. Sure enough, Gansey sat cross-legged on Main Street, slowly waving a newly painted piece of cardboard in the direction of the single-window air conditioner. At night, he looked particularly small, or the warehouse looked particularly large. Lit only by the small lamp he'd set on the floor beside his journal, the room yawned above, a wizard's cave full of books and maps and three-legged surveying devices. The night was flat black against the hundreds of window panes, making them just another wall. Ronan placed the wooden box he'd just dreamt next to Gansey, and then retreated to the other end of the tiny street. Gansey was quaint and scholarly with his nighttime wireframe slid down his nose. He looked from Ronan to the box and back again and said nothing, but he did take one of his earbuds out as he continued running a line of glue along a miniature seam. Popping a bone in his neck, Ronan let Chainsaw down to entertain herself. She proceeded to turn over the wastebasket and go through the contents. It was a noisy process, rustling like a secretary at work. The scenario felt familiar and time-worn. The two of them had lived together at Monmouth for nearly as long as Gansey had been in Henrietta, almost 2 years. Of course, the building hadn't looked like this in the beginning. It had been just one of the many abandoned factories and warehouses in the valley. They never got torn down. They just got forgotten. Monmouth Manufacturing was no different. But then Gansey had come to town with his crazy dream and his ridiculous Camaro, and he'd bought the building for cash. No one else noticed it, even though they drove by every day. It was on its knees in the ryegrass and the creeper, and he saved it. The fall after Ronan and Gansey had become friends, the summer before Adam, they'd spent half their free time hunting for Glendower and the other half hauling junk out of the second floor. The floor was furred with flaked curls of paint. Wires trailed from the ceiling like jungle vines. Chipped plywood made lean-tos against hideous desks from a nuclear age. The boys burned crap in the overgrown lot until the cops asked them to stop, and then Gansey had explained his situation and the cops had gotten out of their cars to help finish the job. Back then, it had surprised Ronan. He hadn't realized yet that Gansey could persuade even the sun to pause and give him the time. They worked on Glendower and Monmouth Manufacturing for months. The first week of June, Gansey found a headless statue of a bird with King carved on its belly in Welsh. The second week, they wired a refrigerator in the upstairs bathroom right next to the toilet. The third week, someone killed Neil Lynch. The fourth week, Ronan moved in. Fixing a cereal box front porch into place, Gansey asked, "What was the first thing you took out? Did you always know?" Ronan found himself pleased to be quizzed. "No. It was a bunch of flowers, the first time." He remembered that dream. A haunted old wood, blue, blousy flowers growing in the dapples. He'd walked through the whispering trees with an often-present dream companion, and then a huge presence had blown through the canopy, sudden as a storm cloud. Ronan, bereft with terror and the certainty that this alien force wanted him, only him, had snatched at anything he could before being ripped aloft. When he'd woken, he'd clutched a pulpy handful of blue flowers of a sort no one had seen before. Ronan tried now to explain them to Gansey, the wrongness of the stamen, the furriness of the petals, the impossibility of them. Even to Gansey, he couldn't admit the joy and terror of the moment.
the heart-pounding thought, I'm just like my father. As Ronan spoke, Gansey's eyes were half-closed, turned toward the night. His thoughtless expression was one of wonder or of pain. With Gansey, they were so often the same thing. That was an accident, Gansey reasoned. He capped the glue. Now you can do it on purpose. Ronan couldn't decide if he should exaggerate his prowess or emphasize the difficulty of the task. I can sometimes control what I bring, but I can't choose what I dream about. Tell me what it's like. Gansey stretched to get a mint leaf from his pocket. He put it on his tongue and spoke around it. Walk me through it. What happens? From the vicinity of the wastebasket, there was a satisfying tearing sound as a small raven ripped a large envelope lengthwise. First, Ronan replied, I get a beer. Gansey shot him a withering look. The truth was that Ronan didn't understand the process very well himself. He knew it had something to do with how he fell asleep. The dreams were more pliable when he drank. Less like taut anxiety and more like taffy, susceptible to careful manipulation until all at once they broke. He was about to say this, but instead what came out of his mouth was, they're mostly in Latin. Beg pardon? They always have been. I just didn't know it was Latin until I got older. Ronan, there's no reason for that, Gansey said sternly, as if Ronan had hurled a toy on the floor. No shit, Sherlock, but there it is. Is it your thoughts that are in Latin? Or the dialogue? Do other people speak Latin in them? Like am I in your dreams? Oh, yes, baby. It amused Ronan to say this, a lot. He laughed enough that Chainsaw abandoned her paper shredding to verify that he wasn't dying. Ronan sometimes dreamt of Adam, too. The latter boy sullen and elegant and fluently disdainful of dream Ronan's clumsy attempts to communicate. Gansey pressed on. And I speak Latin? Dude, you speak Latin in real life. That's not a good comparison. Yeah, fine, if you're there, but usually it's strangers. Or the signs. The signs are in Latin, and the trees speak it. Like in Capeswater? Yes, like in Capeswater. In familiar Capeswater. Although Ronan surely hadn't been there before this spring. Still, arriving there for the first time, it felt like a dream he'd forgotten. Coincidence, Gansey said, because it wasn't, and because it had to be said. And when you want something? If I want something, I have to be, like, aware enough to know that I want it. Almost awake, and I have to really want it, and then I have to hold it. Ronan was about to use the example of the Camaro keys, but thought better of it. I have to hold it, not as a dream, but like it's real. I don't understand. I can't pretend to hold it. I have to really hold it. I still don't understand. Neither did Ronan, but he didn't know how to say it any better. For a moment he was quiet, thinking. No sound but Chainsaw returning to the floor to pick at the corpse of the envelope. Look, it's like a handshake, he said finally. You know when some guy goes in for the shake, and you've never met him before, and he puts it out there, and you just know in that moment right before the shake if it's going to be sweaty or not? It's like that. So what you're saying is you can't explain it. I did explain it. No, you used nouns and verbs together in a pleasing but illogical format. I did explain it, Ronan insisted so ferociously that Chainsaw flapped, certain she was in trouble. It's a nightmare, man. It's when you dream of getting bit and when you wake up your arm hurts. It's that. Oh, said Gansey. Does it hurt? Sometimes, when he took something out of a dream, it was such a senseless rush that it left the real world pale and unsaturated for hours after. Sometimes he couldn't move his hands. Sometimes Gansey found him and thought he was drunk. Sometimes he really was drunk. Does that mean yes? What is this thing, anyway? Gansey had picked up the wooden box. When he turned one of the wheels, one of the buttons on the other side depressed. A puzzle box. What does that mean? Fuck if I know, that's just what it was called in the dream.
Gansey eyed Ronan over the top of his wireframes.
Don't use that voice on me.
You have no idea whatsoever.
I think it's supposed to translate things. That's what it did in the dream.
Up close, the carvings were letters and words. The buttons were so small, and the letters so precise that it was impossible to see how it could have been made. Also impossible was how the wheels of characters could have been fixed into the box without there being any seams in the rainbow-striped grain of the wood.
Latin on that side, Gansey observed. He turned it. Greek here.
What's that?
Sanskrit, I think.
Is this Coptic?
Ronan said, who the hell knows what Coptic looks like?
You, apparently.
I'm pretty sure that's what this is.
And this side, with the wheels, is us.
Well, our alphabet, anyway, and it's set to English words.
But what is this side?
The rest of these are dead languages, but I don't recognize this one.
Look, Ronan said, pushing to his feet. You're overcomplicating this.
Stalking to Gansey, he took the box. He spun a few of the wheels on the English side, and at once buttons on the other sides began to move and shift. Something about their progress was illogical.
That hurts my head, Gansey said. Ronan showed the English side to him. The letters read, tree.
He flipped it to the Latin side. The letters had shifted to read, bratus. Then round to the Greek side, dendron.
So it's translated the English into all those other languages.
That's tree in all those.
I still don't know what language this is.
Tire.
That doesn't sound like...
Gansey broke off, his knowledge of perished linguistic oddities exhausted.
God, I'm tired.
So sleep.
Gansey gave him a look. It was a look that asked how Ronan, of all people, could be so stupid to think that sleep was just a thing that could be so easily acquired.
Ronan said, so let's drive to the barns.
Gansey gave him another look. It was a look that asked how Ronan, of all people, could be so stupid as to think that Gansey would agree to something so illegal on so little sleep.
Ronan said, so let's go get some orange juice.
Gansey considered. He looked to where his key sat on the desk beside his mint plant. The clock beside it, a repellently ugly vintage number Gansey had found lying by a bin at the dump, said 3:32. Gansey said, okay. They went and got some orange juice.
6. You are an unbelievable phone tramp, Blue said.
Orla, unoffended, replied, you're just jealous that this isn't your job.
I am not.
Sitting on the floor of her mother's kitchen, Blue glared up at her older cousin as she tied her shoe. Orla towered over her in a shirt stunning both for its skin-tight fit and its paisley print. The flare of her bell-bottoms was capacious enough to hide small animals in. She waved the phone above Blue in a hypnotic figure eight. The phone in question was the psychic hotline that operated out of the second floor of 300 Fox Way. For a dollar a minute, customers received a gentle probing of their archetypes. A slightly more than gentle probing, if Orla answered, and a host of tactful suggestions for how to improve their fates. Everyone in the house took turns answering it. Everyone, as Orla was pointing out, but Blue. Blue's summer job required absolutely no extrasensory perception. In fact, working at Nino's would have probably been unbearable if she'd possessed any more than 5 senses. Blue generally had a policy of not doing things she despised, but she despised working at Nino's and had yet to quit, or to get fired for that matter. Waitressing required patience, a fixed and convincing smile, and the ability to continuously turn the other cheek while keeping diet sodas topped up. Blue possessed only one of these attributes at any given time, and it was never the one she needed. It didn't help that Nino's clientele was mostly Aglimby boys who often thought rudeness was a louder sort of flirting. The problem was that it paid well.
Oh, please, Orla said. Everyone knows that's why you're so irritable.
Blue stood up to face her cousin. Apart from her large nose, Orla was beautiful.
She had long brown hair crowned with an embroidered headband, a long face pierced by a nose stud, and a long body made longer by platform wedges. Even when standing, Blue, barely 5 feet tall, only came to Orla's deeply brown throat. "I don't care about being psychic or not," which was partially true. Blue didn't envy Orla's clairvoyance. She did envy her ability to be different without even trying. Blue had to try. A lot. Again with the waving of the phone.
"Don't lie to me, Blue. I can read your mind."
"You cannot," Blue replied tersely, scraping her button-covered wallet from the counter. Just because she wasn't psychic didn't mean she was clueless on the process. She glanced at the oven clock. Almost late. Practically late. Barely on time. "Unlike some people, my sense of self-worth isn't tied into my occupation."
"Oh," Orla crowed, galloping down the hall, stork-like. She traded her Henrietta accent for a gloriously snotty version of Old South. "Someone's been hanging out with Richard Campbell Gansey III too much. My sense of self-worth isn't tied into my occupation."
This last bit was said with the most exaggerated rendition of Gansey's accent possible. She sounded like a drunk Robert E. Lee. Blue reached past Orla for the door.
"Is this about me calling you a phone tramp?
I don't take it back. No one needs to hear their future in that voice you do. Mom, make Orla go away. I have to go." From her perch in the reading room, Maura looked up. She was a slightly taller version of her daughter, her features amused where Blue's were keen.
"Are you going to Nino's?
Come take a card." Despite her lateness, Blue was unable to resist.
"It'll only be a moment."
Ever since she was small, she'd loved the ritual of a single card reading. Unlike the elaborate Celtic cross tarot spreads her mother usually did for her clients, the single card reading she did for Blue was playful, fond, and brief. It wasn't so much a clairvoyant experience as a 30-second bedtime story where Blue was always the hero. Blue joined her mother, her spiky reflection dimly visible in the table's dull sheen. Not looking up from her tarot cards, Maura gave Blue's hand an affectionate shake and flipped over a card at random.
"Ah, there you are."
It was the Page of Cups, the card Maura always said reminded her of Blue. In this deck, the art was of a fresh-faced young person holding a jewel-studded goblet. The suite of cups represented relationships, love and friendship, and the page stood for new and budding possibilities. This particular bedtime story was one Blue had heard too many times before. She could anticipate exactly what her mother was going to say next.
"Look at all the potential she holds inside her."
Blue cut her off. "When does the potential start being a real thing?"
"Ah, Blue."
"Don't ah, Blue me." Blue released her mother's hand. "I just want to know when it stops being potential and starts being something more." Maura briskly shuffled the card back into her deck.
"Do you want the answer you're going to like, or the real one?"
Blue harumphed. There was only one answer she ever wanted.
"Maybe you're already something more. You make other psychics so powerful just by being there. Maybe the potential you bring out in other people is your something more."
Blue had known her entire life that she was a rarity, and it was nice to be useful, but it wasn't enough. It was not, her soul thought, something more. Very coolly, she said,
"I'm not going to be a sidekick."
In the hallway, Orla repeated in Gansey's southern nectar,
"I'm not gonna be a sidekick."
"You should stop hanging out with millionaires, then."
Maura made an ill-tempered tss between her teeth. "Orla, don't you have a call to make?"
"It doesn't matter. I'm going to work," Blue said, trying to keep Orla's words from digging in. But it was true that she looked a lot cooler at school than she did surrounded by psychics and rich boys.
"No," she thought. "No, it's not about that. It's about what I do, not what I am."
It felt a little feeble, though. It had been a lot easier when Adam, the poorest of the lot, had seemed more like her. Now she felt as if she had something to prove. The others were team power, and she was supposed to be team ingenuity or something.
Her mother waved a card at her in farewell. Bye. Will you be home for dinner? I'm making midlife crisis.
Oh, Blue said. I guess I'll have a slice, if you're making it already.
When Blue got to Nino's, she discovered that Gansey, Adam, Noah, and Ronan had already commandeered one of the big tables in the back. Because she couldn't come to them, they'd brought the Glendower discussion to her. Ha, she thought. Take that, Orla. Adam and Gansey sat in a cracked orange booth along the wall. Noah and Ronan sat on chairs opposite. Resting in the spotlight provided by the hanging green light was a wooden box. A battalion of foreign language dictionaries surrounded it. With effort, Blue compared her current image of the boys with the first time she'd seen them. They'd not only been strangers then, they'd been the enemy. It was hard to remember seeing them that way. Whatever her identity crisis was, it seemed to live at home, not with the boys. She wouldn't have predicted that. Blue brought a pitcher of iced tea to the table. What's that? Jane, Gansey said joyfully. Adam said, it's a wizard in a box. It will do your homework, Noah added. And it's been dating your girlfriend, Ronan finished. Blue scowled. Are you all drunk? They dismissed her question and instead excitedly demonstrated the principles of the wooden box. She was less surprised than most people would have been to discover it was a magical translating box. She was more surprised to discover the boys had possessed the forethought to bring the other dictionaries. We wanted to know if it was always right, Gansey said, and it seems to be. Hold on, Blue replied. She left the boys to take the drink orders of a couple at table 14. They both wanted iced tea. Nino's was unfairly famous for its iced tea. There was even a sign in the window proclaiming that it had the best in Henrietta, despite the fact that Blue could attest to the tea-making process being completely unremarkable. Raven boys must be easy prey to propaganda, she thought. When she returned, she leaned on the table beside Adam, who touched her wrist. She didn't know what to do in response. Touch it back? The moment had passed. She resented her body for not giving her the correct answer. She asked, What is that other language, by the way? We don't know, Gansey said around his straw. Why is the tea so good here? I spit in it. Let me see this thing. She accepted the box. It had some heft to it, as if one would find workings to all these dials inside. It felt actually a lot like Gansey's journal on Glendower. It had been lavishly dreamt, not what she'd expected of Ronan. Fingers careful on the smooth, cool dials, Blue moved the wheels on the English side of the box so that they read Blue. Buttons sucked in, and wheels turned on the other sides of the box, fluid and silent. Blue turned it slowly to read each side. Hyacinthus Shoshen Nila Chilea. One side was blank. Gansey pointed to each side for Latin, Coptic, Sanskrit, something we don't know, and this is supposed to be Greek. Isn't that funny that it's blank? Derisively, Ronan said, No, the ancient Greeks didn't have a word for blue. Everyone at the table looked at him. What the hell, Ronan? Said Adam. It's hard to imagine, Gansey mused, how this evidently successful classical education never seems to make it into your school papers. They never ask the right questions, Ronan replied. At the front of the restaurant, the door opened. It would fall to Blue to seat the new party, but she lingered by the table, frowning at the box. She said, I have a right question. What is the language on this side? Ronan's expression was petulant. Gansey tilted his head. We don't know. Blue pointed at Ronan, who curled a lip. He does. Somewhere in there. I know it. You don't know shit, Ronan said. There was the very briefest of pauses. It was true that this sort of venom was not unusual from Ronan, but it had been a very long while since it had been used so forcefully on Blue. She drew herself up, everything prickling. Then Gansey said, very slowly, Ronan, you're never going to talk to Jane like that again. Both Adam and Blue stared at Gansey, who concentrated his gaze on his napkin. It wasn't what he said, but how he looked at no one when he said it that made the moment strange. Blue, feeling oddly warm around the cheeks, told Gansey, "I don't need you to stand up for me." "Don't you," this was directed at Ronan, "think I'll let you talk to me like that, especially not just because you're mad I'm right." And she whirled toward the front. She heard Adam say, "You're such a dick," and Noah laugh. Her spirit sank as she saw who stood at the hostess stand, Joseph Kavinsky. He was unmistakable. The sort of raven boy who was clearly an import from elsewhere. Everything about his facial structure, the long nose, the hollowed-out, heavy-lidded eyes, the dark arch of his eyebrows, was completely unlike the valley faces she'd grown up with. Like many of the other raven boys, he sported massive sunglasses, spiked hair, a small earring, a chain around his neck, and a white tank top. But unlike the other raven boys, he terrified Blue. "Hey, baby doll," he greeted Blue. He was already standing too close, moving restlessly. He was always moving. There was something erratic and vulgar about the full line of his lips, like he'd swallow her if he got close enough. She hated the smell of him. He was infamous, even at her school. You wanted something to get you through your exams, he had it. You wanted a fake license, he could get it. You wanted something to hurt you, he was it. "I am not a baby doll," Blue said icily, picking up a laminated menu. Her face was burning again. "Table for one?" But he wasn't even listening to her. He rocked on his heels, jerking his chin up to see who else was in the restaurant. Without looking at her again, he said, "My party's already here." He walked away, like she'd never been there. She wasn't sure if she couldn't forgive Kavinsky for always managing to make her feel so insignificant, or herself for knowing it was coming and being unable to guard herself against it. She stuffed the menu back in the hostess station and stood there for a second, hating them all, hating this job, feeling strangely humiliated. Then she took a deep breath and filled up Table 14's tea. Kavinsky headed directly to the large table in the back, and the postures of the other boys all changed drastically. Adam looked at the table with a studied disinterest. Smudgy Noah ducked his head down into his shoulders but couldn't take his eyes off the newcomer. Gansey stood, leaning against the table, and there was something threatening rather than respectful about it. Ronan, however, was the one who had transformed the most. Though his casual position, arms crossed, remained the same, his shoulders were knotted with visible tension. Something about his eyes was ferocious and alive, in the same way that they had been when he'd launched the plane in the field. "I saw your POS out front," Kavinsky told Gansey, "and I remembered I had something for lunch." Laughing, he dropped a dry, tangled pile in front of Ronan. Ronan eyed the gift, one eyebrow raised in glorious disdain. Leaning back, he pulled one of the strands to reveal that it was a collection of wristbands identical to the ones he always wore. "How sweet, man." Ronan lifted one higher like spaghetti. "It goes with everything." "Like your mom," Kavinsky agreed with good humor. "What am I supposed to do with them?" "Hell if I know. I just thought of you. Re-gift them. White rabbit shit." "Elephant," murmured Gansey.
"Don't bring politics into this, Dick," Kavinsky replied. He slapped a palm on Ronan's shaved head and rubbed it. Ronan looked ready to bite him.
"Well, I am out. Things to do. Enjoy your book club, ladies."
He didn't even look at Blue as he left. "Him not hitting on you is a good thing," she told herself. She felt invisible, unseeable. "Is this how Noah feels?" Gansey said, "The only thing that gives me any joy is imagining the used car dealership he'll be working in by the time he's 30. Ronan, head down, kept studying the leather bands. One of his hands was a fist. Blue wondered what the real meaning of Kavinsky's gift was. She wondered if Ronan knew the real meaning. "Like I said," Gansey muttered, "trouble." 7. The gray man hated his current rental car. He'd got the distinct impression it hadn't been handled enough by humans when it was young and now would never be pleasant to be around. Since he'd picked it up, it had already tried to bite him several times and had spent a considerable amount of time resisting his efforts to achieve the speed limit. Also, it was champagne. Ridiculous color for a car. He would have returned it for another, but the gray man made a point of staying unmemorable if he could. His previous rental had acquired an unfortunate and possibly incriminating stain in the back seat. Better to put some distance between himself and it. After dutifully filling the car with Green Mantle's machines and dials, the gray man went on an electrical goose chase. He didn't mind terribly that the flashing lights and humming alarms and scattered needles weren't painting a coherent map to the Grey Warren. Henrietta had considerable charms. The downtown was populated by daintily greasy sandwich shops and aggressively down home junk shops, sway-backed porches, and square columns, all of the buildings tired but tidy as library books. He peered through the car window as he passed by. Locals on chairs on porches peered back. The readings continued to be meaningless, so he parked the champagne monstrosity at the corner drugstore which advertised the best tuna fish in town. He ordered a sandwich and a milkshake from a red-lipped lady, and as he leaned on the stainless steel counter, the power went out. The red-lipped lady used a meaty fist to thump the now dormant milkshake machine and swore in a soft accent that made it sound affectionate. She assured him, "It'll come back on in a minute." All of the shelves and greeting cards and pharmaceuticals looked eerie and apocalyptic in the indirect light from the front windows. "Does this happen a lot?" "Since this spring, yes, sir. Goes out, gets them surges, too, blows out them transformers, and everything catches fire. Turns on the stadium lights, too, down at Aglinby when nobody's there for a game. Sure, all those terrible boys are gone for the summer. Well, most all of them. But you're not staying, are you? A few weeks. Then you'll be here for the 4th. The gray man had to drag up a mental calendar. He didn't celebrate many holidays. "You come down here and see the county show," she said, giving his half-blended milkshake a dispirited twitch. "You get yourself a nice view of the fireworks from the courthouse. Don't be fooled by those other ones." "The ones people do at home?" "The Aglinby ones," she said. "Some of them boys blow up all kinds of things they shouldn't be getting into. Terrorize old ladies. Don't know why the sheriff don't stop him." "Him?" The gray man was interested in how the plural Aglinby ones suddenly became a singular him. She seemed to be in a reverie, watching cars go slowly by the big pane glass windows. Eventually she continued, "Probably it's Hepco's fault. They knew their wires was old, but do they replace them?" "No." He blinked at the sudden shift in conversation. "Hepco? Beg pardon?" "Oh, Henrietta Electric Power Company." Only with her accent it sounded like Henrietta Electric Power Company. As if invoked by her voice, the electricity came back on. "Oh, there it is back again. Told you there's no need for worries." "Oh," the gray man said with a glance at the crackling fluorescent lights overhead. "I wasn't worried." She chuckled. It was a deeply satisfied and knowing sort of laugh. "I reckon not." The tuna fish was good. It was the only one he'd had since he arrived, however, so he couldn't say whether it was the best in town. He kept driving. Victorians turned into fields as he crossed over the interstate, past steepled barns and white farmhouses, active goats and deceased pickup trucks. Everything was painted in the same color palette, ruddy greens and deep green reds. Even the rubbish looked as if it had grown from the sloping hills. Only the mountains looked out of place, blue ghosts on every horizon. Much to the gray man's surprise, Green Mantle's meters seemed to be coming to a consensus. They led him onto another back road. Ramblers and mailboxes poked through the soil. His phone rang. It was his brother. The gray man's stomach wrung itself out. The phone rang only twice.
missed call. His brother had never intended for him to pick up. He merely wanted this. The gray man stopping the car, wondering if he was supposed to return the call. Wondering if his brother was going to call back, untangling the wired threads in his gut. Finally, a Labrador retriever barking at the door grounded him again. He shut the phone into the glove box out of sight. Back to Green Mantle's devices. They led him to a yellow house with an empty carport. With the EMF reader in one hand and a cesium magnetometer in the other, he climbed into the heat and followed the energy field. He ducked under a desolate clothesline. There was a doghouse, but no dog. The air had the dry, complicated scent of a cornfield, but there was no cornfield. He was eerily reminded of the foreboding drugstore with the lights off. In the backyard was an ambitious vegetable garden where seven impeccable